Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Dengbior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, October 24th, 2019. A breakthrough in efforts to get aid to the Nuba Mountains.
This brings tremendous hope to the people in Nuba who's been suffering under this conflict for such a long time.
And people in the disputed Abyei region want their voices to be heard.
Till now, the government of Sudan has not mentioned anything related to Abyei in its agenda during the transition period.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's Council of Ministers yesterday granted permission for the World Food Program to visit Kauda in the Nuba Mountains for the first time in nearly 9 years. The council was also briefed in Khartoum on the state of peace talks with the armed movements operating in the area and agreed to review the substantial bonuses paid to directors of government companies. Peter Smerson of the World Food Program in Nairobi says WFP Executive Director David Beasley arrived yesterday in Kauda from Juba.
The World Food Program Executive Director, David Beasley, landed in Kauda, a town in South Kordofan, which is in the Republic of Sudan, and it lies in territory, however, controlled by the Sudan People's Liberation Army North, which is opposed to Khartoum. South Kordofan and Blue Nile, in those areas, are controlled by the Sudan People's Liberation Army North, which is opposed to Khartoum, even though they fall under Khartoum's rule legally.
Right, and it's kind of a breakthrough now because of the ouster of Omar al-Bashir and this new sovereign council in Sudan, right?
Correct, yes. I mean, basically, we've seen some tangible recent improvements in humanitarian access nationwide in Sudan, not only in the SPLM N areas, and the SPLM-N has expressed flexibility about humanitarian aid in the future. But basically, the Sudan government endorsed this mission as a show of good faith, and the SPLM North has expressed its appreciation.
This trip that Beasley was able to make, David Beasley, into the Kauda area is just an assessment right now, right? How hopeful are you that pretty soon you'll be able to get up and running with getting in some aid actually in there?
Yeah, it was just a very brief visit, just to assess and make sure that it was possible to do this after 8 years. He succeeded and then went on to Juba in South Sudan. But basically, yes, it follows a rebel leader who said on Monday that Sudan had agreed to open humanitarian access to Darfur, the Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile for the first time in 8 years. This followed the Sudan government and the rebel groups agreeing last Friday to the roadmap and signing a declaration confirming their commitment to it.
That was Peter Smerden of the World Food Program speaking from Nairobi with my colleague Carol Van Dam this past hour. Brian Boyette, a journalist and aid worker who has lived in the Nuba Mountains for several years, says the agreement represents a huge achievement for humanitarian access to the area.
This brings tremendous hope to the people in Nuba who's been suffering under this conflict for such a long time.
And what kind of aid are they bringing to the area in the Nuba Mountains?
Right now, David Beasley was given the permission from the transitional government that has just replaced Bashir, from Prime Minister Hamdok, and he was given permission from the SPLM North leader Abdulaziz, and he was given permission from the South Sudan president. So all of these people have agreed to allow David Beasley to go and see the people who have been suffering under war and then open the door for discussions about how they can access the area for humanitarian access and providing aid for the people.
Now, you know, when they come in and they do an assessment, how long does that take before they actually can bring in the aid?
There's still a lot of political issues that may cause blocking of aid, which during Bashir's regime, they blocked any sort of aid getting into the Nuba Mountains. But now that the government has changed, suddenly this is, you know, it's not a clean slate, but it opens new doors to allow the opportunity to take place. So this is more of a visit to see if this is something that could happen. The helicopter that brought the WFP delegation was coming from Juba, and they flew into the Nuba Mountains, landed in Kauta. So this was just to see, will WFP be allowed to do this? Is it something that could be done? And then from here, they will go back to the different parties and talk to them to see if they would allow them to free access to provide humanitarian aid.
That was Ryan Boyette, who worked for Samaritan's Purse, an evangelical Christian aid group active in East Africa. Boyette lived in the Nuba Mountains for years and trained Sudanese to be reporters. He was speaking this past hour with my colleague, Carol Van Dam. Some members of the Ngok Dinka community from the disputed Abyei region who live in Khartoum say they're disappointed the issue over Abyei's final status has not been raised in the Juba peace talks between the new Sudanese authorities and armed groups. A member of the Sudan Sovereign Council says Abyei is on the agenda, which the government will discuss soon with South Sudan. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Inhabitants of Abyei living in Khartoum say the peace talks between the Sudanese authorities and armed groups might silence the guns in Darfur, Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile. But they say they are concerned that the dispute between Khartoum and Juba over the final status of Abyei remains unresolved and say it should have been raised in the talks. Karima Anthony, who owns a Sudanese national identity card, says she feels betrayed by the Sudanese and South Sudanese authorities who have failed to resolve the matter for so long. Speaking in Arabic, Anthony blames both Sudan and South Sudan for neglecting the Abyei issue during the peace negotiations. She says she believes Abyei should be annexed to Sudan and its final status should be determined as part of the peace negotiations currently underway in Juba.
Till now, the government of Sudan has not mentioned anything related to Abyei in its agenda during the transition period. Abyei is not a priority for them. This has a lot of impact on our people in the coming period. I do not know what is the fate of the region or who cares about it. And even up to now, we do not know who is responsible of this issue.
Speaking in Arabic, Padang Kual Ngor, a member of the Abyei civic organization in Sudan, believes the environment in both countries is now suitable for leaders to make a political decision and end the suffering of the people in Abyei.
For years, every government that comes says the Abyei issue is a complicated matter and we have to wait till it is resolved. Now there is a new beginning of a bilateral relationship between Sudan and South Sudan, but they don't even want to mention it in their meetings. A citizen of Abyei is suffering and the humanitarian situation in the region continues to deteriorate.
Speaking in Arabic, John Deng Alor, who works in Khartoum as a primary school teacher, says he feels betrayed by the Sudanese transitional government after their active participation in the overthrowing former President Omar al-Bashir's government.
As a
BA community, we don't know where we belong, whether we belong to Sudan or South Sudan. Even in recent formation of the transitional government, there is no one who represents BA. There is a total marginalization for our leaders from both Sudan and South Sudan. We need an urgent and collective decision on this issue.
Speaking to hundreds of Ngok Dinka people in Khartoum last weekend, a member of the Sudanese Sovereign Council, Sadiq Taur, blamed both government for failing to provide the area with basic needs. Speaking in Arabic, Taur says the new transitional government in Sudan should engage parties concerned with the Abyei matter soon to determine the fate of the region.
The issue of Abyei involves discussions and agreements by the parties and the international community. We need a lot of time and mechanisms, and we don't want to preempt things. But I am here urging both parties, Sudan and South Sudan, to begin providing a practical service provision to the citizens of Abyei.
Luka Byong, a prominent South Sudanese politician who hails from the Abyei region, believes the African Union's proposal would help resolve the final status of the area. He notes the political environment is now conducive for both countries to come to some sort of agreement over the disputed regions since the ouster of former Sudan President Omar al-Bashir.
Abiy can contribute in cementing this relationship, and that could be a good test to the two countries. To what level can they reflect their commitment to coexist as a sistering country by resolving the issue of Abiy, which is a very simple, and also the parameters of resolving the issue of Abiy have been provided by the African Union as an African solution to an African problem.
Earlier this month, a South Sudanese politician who also hails from the Abiy region, Nyanagwek Kwol, suggested that Abiy could be established as an integrated economic zone with two separate administrations for Ngok Dinka and Mesiria Arabs and the people granted dual citizenship by both Sudan and South Sudan. Kwol believes that way the area might experience development and provide services to the locals. For VOA News, I am Michael Atiit in Khartoum.
Regional leaders from South Sudan, Africa, and the Arab region have gathered in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, to tackle growing water scarcity, challenges of food production caused by climate change, and the use of various technologies that affect economic growth. A director of hydrology at the South Sudan Ministry of Water Resources and Irrigation says the forum is a chance to exchange experiences in areas of cooperation on the use of the Nile waters. Walki Simon Mudu files this story for VOA from Cairo.
Dubbed Cairo Water Week, the event is organized by Egypt with support from regional and international agencies. It has drawn hundreds of delegates from around the world, including experts from Europe and the United States. Engineer Simon Otuang, Director of Hydrology and Surveys at South Sudan's Water Resources and Irrigation Ministry, says the five-day forum is a chance for South Sudan to learn from other countries' experiences how to mitigate challenges arising from the shared use of the Nile waters, as well as the growing challenges of climate change.
The water don't know the borders. That is why we have to talk about the arrangements. How can we share this resource? And in sharing this resource, actually, it's very important things. We want to now face the resource which we are sharing. Then after that, we put down the mechanisms or institutions or the frameworks for us to manage this resource.
Participants say the key issue is cooperation, especially among member states across the Nile Basin Initiative, as well as the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, or GERD. Walid Hakiki, head of the Central Directorate for Water Resources and Uses at the Egyptian Water Resources and Irrigation Ministry, says the forum is being held to address the challenges arising from shared water use.
We have now the GERD issues, the Great Ethiopian Dam, which is now still under negotiation between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia. We didn't reach an agreement yet how we'll fill that dam, how we'll operate that dam together with other dams in the basin. This is something that we need to agree on, so that we really, as I said, we have a win-win situation without anyone to lose.
Since Ethiopia initiated the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam in 2011, relations have been strained between Cairo and Addis Ababa. While Ethiopia says it wants to produce hydroelectric power from the dam, Egypt is concerned the dam will do more harm than good on the Nile Basin waters. Experts at the forum warn that without cooperation on the shared water resources, it would be difficult for countries in the region to address the growing challenges of water scarcity. Mohamed Helal, assistant professor of law at Ohio University in the United States, who gave a presentation during the forum, says international laws governing use of shared waters give equal use of waters to member states in the region for water usage.
Now, there is an assumption that upstream states like the equitable reasonable utilization rule, and that downstream states like Egypt prefer the significant harm rule. That is inaccurate to a certain extent, because it is my contention that both rules serve the interests of upstream and downstream countries.
Hakiki says the Cairo Water Week was organized in a bid to mitigate some of the disagreements over the use of the Nile Basin and the challenges that lie ahead.
Actually, water issues in the region and in the continent is very stressing, yeah, and this is even worsening with the climate change. And we, as a region, we think that really water is one of the very important issues that we need to tackle and try to enhance the management of our limited water resources.
Participants are also pushing for effective implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals regarding water and sanitation. Experts say those goals are far from being achieved with just 10 years left to the 2030 deadline. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Cairo, Egypt.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a female South Sudanese editor is being recognized for her work in journalism. Find out more when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you able to rest on the weekends, or do you work throughout?
Actually, I don't rest on weekends because I'm a businesswoman. I have to run out my business throughout the weeks. Yeah, I only rest that when I'm sick. That is where I can rest. But if I'm very okay, there is nothing that I can do than running my business.
Yeah, of course, I find time to rest during weekends. Except on emergencies, I go out. But for the good part of the weekends, I normally rest at home.
As a student, you cannot have ample time to rest. So you can attend classes from Monday to Friday. And you can, if there is something that you need to study, you can study. But I cannot say that I rest throughout the weekend.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The Dutch government has donated $22 million to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, to provide clean drinking water, sanitation services, and improve hygiene in South Sudan. The Netherlands ambassador to South Sudan stressed the importance of investing in vulnerable people, saying, quote, "a healthy and resilient population is better positioned to take their country forward," end quote. Ding Magat has more for VOA from WOW.
Dutch Ambassador to Juba Janet Albada and UNICEF Country Representative Mohamed Ayoya signed the partnership agreement at the Dutch Embassy in Juba today. Ambassador Albada says the money will assist thousands of people already affected by heavy floods in South Sudan, as well as support initiatives that focus on flood preparedness.
These floods are further aggravating this already fragile situation, and all the challenges are increasingly weakening the capacities of South Sudanese citizens to recover from the effects of conflicts and build resilience towards sustainable peace, stability and development, with women and children as the most affected population. In the Netherlands, we always say water is life and that life is meaningless without water. But that life is not accessible to most South Sudanese people.
Albata says that it is unacceptable to the people of Holland, but also the people of South Sudan are struggling to rebuild when peace has come. Mohamed Ayoya, UNICEF's country representative in South Sudan, stressed the consequences of poor water hygiene.
The lack of water, as the ambassador said, not only exposes the children, but the people to diseases. And unfortunately, some of them can be quite deadly. Among them, as you know, is cholera, which this country has known at some point in its history. And with the floods that are now going on in many parts of the country, it's also a risk.
Ayoya says the Netherlands UNICEF Water Sanitation and Hygiene or WASH partnership in South Sudan focuses on creating resilience in communities in Rumbek, Yambio, Torit and Bor.
This project will provide clean drinking water to 250,000 people and improve sanitation and hygiene practices to 175,000 people. And hygiene education will also be implemented in schools that UNICEF is supporting.
Only 5 million South Sudanese, or 41% of the population, have access to safe drinking water, and only 10% of the population has access to adequate sanitation services, according to the United Nations. Juba resident Juliet Luciano says the water she fetches from a borehole in Hai Dar es Salaam has affected her health.
I used to buy water from Tirila, and sometimes I used to get it from the borehole. That water in the borehole, when you use it, you just use it for taking shower or bathing or doing anything. But if you used to drink, even will affect your body.
Luciano is calling on the government to fix the water problem in Juba. The four-year resilience program supported by Holland aims to provide access to clean drinking water, sanitation and hygiene services to more than 2 million vulnerable people by August 2023. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
Four women, including South Sudanese Anna Nemeriano of the Juba Monitor, are recipients of this year's Courage in Journalism Awards, given by the International Women's Media Foundation. Nemeriano is being recognized for her audacity to report in South Sudan, a place that has made headlines for its ill treatment of journalists. As editor-in-chief of the Juba Monitor, Anna Nemeriano is used to running editorial meetings and assigning stories to reporters who work at the independent newspaper in South Sudan's restrictive environment for press freedoms. But Nemeriano says the challenges of the job are compounded by her gender.
It's not easy to be a female journalist, especially as editor-in-chief. It's not easy. There's a lot of threat I'm getting in the office, almost daily.
Nemeriano says South Sudanese security officers regularly intimidate her staff. The late Alfred Taban, the founder of the Juba Monitor, was arrested in July 2016 after National Security accused the paper of incitement. Nemeriano herself was also summoned by National Security. She says being harassed and intimidated is a regular occurrence in South Sudan, but that's not all.
You know, in South Sudan, the government deploy security at the printing press to remove some story from the newspaper before the newspaper is published. And we are calling them the last editor, because after giving news at the printing press, they have to go through it to revise the news. And after that, they will see the one they feel like it's not good, they will take it. But some news even is not, has nothing to be done.
In January 2015, five journalists were killed by unidentified gunmen in South Sudan when a convoy carrying them in western Baragazal state was ambushed, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. British freelance journalist Christopher Allen was shot dead in August 2017 during crossfire in Kaya, South Sudan, between government and rebel forces. Prominent South Sudanese journalist Michael Christopher, the editor of Al Watan, was arrested for 6 weeks without charge in July and August after his paper ran stories about the uprising in neighboring Sudan, a move the Sudanese embassy in Juba was not happy with, according to Reporters Without Borders, who ranks South Sudan 139 in this year's World Press Freedom Index. South Sudan's restrictive environment for press freedom has regularly made Nemeriano's job difficult, she says.
During the conflict in 2013 and 2016, it was not easy to balance his story. If you balance his story, like they're calling Juba Monitor rebels, you know, because when government says something and we want to balance with the information from the opposition, they don't like that.
Has that changed at all?
No, but now it's a bit okay, because now the of Riek Machar signed peace talks. And, you know, things are getting better compared to in the past. Yeah.
Despite the challenges, Nemeriano says she has no plans to slow down.
But I think the most important thing is if something happened to me, I'm not keeping quiet. I have to say it out so that people know what is going on and people know what I've been treated.
Three other women were recipients of IWMF's Courage in Journalism Award, which took place Tuesday night in Washington, D.C. Yeah, go ahead. World Football's governing body, FIFA, released its latest set of monthly rankings on Thursday. The bright stars of South Sudan are the biggest African movers in the rankings. They rose 11 places from September and are now 162nd overall, putting the South Sudan team at 46th in Africa. The Lions of Teranga from Senegal, runners up to the Desert Foxes of Algeria at this year's Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Egypt, remain the number one ranked team in Africa. The Senegalese are 20th overall in the FIFA rankings for October. Senegal is followed by Tunisia at 29, Nigeria at 35, Algeria at 38, and Morocco at 42. Rounding out the top 10 African teams, Egypt is 49, Ghana is 51, Cameroon is 52, the Democratic Republic of Congo is 54, and the Ivory Coast is 56. Taking a look at the very top of the FIFA rankings, Belgium is number one, followed by France, Brazil, England, and Uruguay.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And that's our show for this Thursday. We leave you with the song Abiba by Rex Omar. Listening to Rex Omar with the song Abiba. I'm Ayan Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening and join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Frano de dar.